Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening. It's LA still. Lila won't be with me tonight. She's been tied up with a few things. And we want to, tonight I'm going to do a lot of political and international news. Something I don't usually do. We don't do it that often, but a lot of information has come up recently, and one of the most bizarre stories, I think, and one of the most remarkable stories is this one on WikiLeaks. And the WikiLeaks, I got two articles on this I wanted to read tonight. And everybody knows, everybody in the know, I guess, or who follows it, knows what's happened to Julian Assange. And he, I questioned his motives at first, and I questioned what he was doing at first. But now, you know, I kind of have to appreciate the guy, knowing the kind of hell he's going through. But I think it's interesting to look at what really happened and some of the unusual events surrounding this this thing with WikiLeaks. And how the American government and British government and all these embassies and so on, all the people that were embarrassed are now, you know, demanding this poor guy get, these sentences for a ridiculous charge of rape, which never really happened. It was consensual sex, and it's kind of bizarre. And even the Swedish judge dismissed the case because of the stupidity of it. And he knew that it was brought up by, you know, pressures from the government and so on and so forth. But now he's in prison in England, and I mean this guy is going through political harassment beyond, above and beyond probably what anybody else has. But at the same time, I'm not siding with him, and I'm not siding against him. I intend to stay neutral on this, but I think it's important that people understand what's really happening out there, or at least in, some way. The first article I want to read tonight is called WikiLeaks Sex Files, How Two One-Night Stands Sparked a Worldwide Hunt for Julian Assange. And the Stockholm police wanted to question him regarding the possible rape of a woman and separate allegations from another Swedish admirer with whom he was having a concurrent fling. But there remains a huge question mark over the evidence. Many people believe that the 39-year-old Australian-born whistleblower is the victim of a U.S. government dirty tricks campaign. They argue that the whole squalid affair is a sex failure. A sex fella. I've never heard that word before, but which translates loosely from the Swedish as a honey trap. He is responsible for an avalanche of political leaks. Whether he is also guilty of sexual offenses remains to be seen. But the more one learns about the case, the allegations simply don't ring true. And again, honey trap definition says here, is a scheme in which a victim is lured into a compromising sexual situation to provide an opportunity for blackmail or to set them up for arrest and or discredit or exploit them. I'm going to go to this article and I want to read the remainder. It's from Mail Online, which is the UK paper. The winter morning in backwoods Scandinavia, the crime of a church bell, the chime of a church bell drifts along the snowbound town of Enköping. Does it also toll for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange? Today, this small industrial center, 40 miles west of Stockholm, remains best known, if not known at all, as the birthplace of the adjustable spanner. But in extradition proceedings involving Britain are successful, it could soon be rather more celebrated by the U.S. government, at least, as the place where Mr. Assange made a catastrophic error. Here in a first-floor flat in a dreary apartment block, the mastermind behind the leak of more than 250,000 classified diplomatic cables this month, slept with a female admirer who he had just met at a seminar. She subsequently made a complaint to police. As a result, Assange, believed to be in hiding in England, faces a criminal prosecution and possibly jail. Last night, a European arrest warrant was given by Interpol to Scotland Yard. Stockholm police want to question him regarding the possible rape of a woman and separate allegations from another Swedish admirer with whom he was having a concurrent fling. But there remains a huge question mark over the evidence. Many people believe that the 39-year-old Australian-born whistleblower is the victim of a U.S. government dirty tricks campaign. They argue that the whole squalid affair is a sex failure, which translates loosely from the Swedish as the honey trap. One thing is clear, though Sweden's complex rape laws are central to the story, using a number of sources, including leaked police interviews, we can begin to piece together the sequence of events which led to Assange's liberty being threatened by Stockholm police rather than Washington, where already one U.S. politician has called for him to be executed for spying. The story began on August 11th this year when Assange arrived in Stockholm. He had been invited to be the key speaker at a seminar on war and the role of the media, organized by the center-left Brotherhood movement. His point of contact was a female party official whom we shall refer to as Sarah. Her identity must be protected because of the ongoing legal proceedings. An attractive blonde, Sarah was already a well-known radical feminist in her 30s. She had traveled the world following various fashionable causes. While a research assistant at a local university, she had not only been the protege of a militant feminist academic, but held the post of campus sexual equity officer. Imagine that. Fighting male discrimination in all forms, including sexual harassment, was her forte. Well, Sarah and Assange have never met. But in a series of internet and telephone conversations, they agreed that during his visit, he could stay at her small apartment in central Stockholm. She said she would be away from the city until the day of the seminar itself. What happened over the next few days, while casting an extraordinary light on the values of the two women involved, suggests that even if the WikiLeaks founder is innocent of any charges, he is certainly a man of strong sexual appetites who is not adverse to exploiting his fame. Certainly, his stay was always going to be a very social affair, mingling with like-minded and undoubtedly admiring people. That Thursday, he held court at the Beirut Cafe in Stockholm, and dining with fellow open government campaigners and an American journalist. The following afternoon, Sarah returned to Stockholm 24 hours earlier than planned. In an interview she later gave to police, she was reported to have said, "He, Assange, was there when I came home. He talked a little and decided that he could stay." The pair went out for dinner together at a nearby restaurant. Afterwards, they returned to her flat and had sex. What is not disputed by either of them is that a condom broke, an event which, as we shall see, would later take on great significance. At the time, however, the pair continued to be friendly enough the next day, a Saturday, when with Sarah even throwing a party for him at her home in the evening. The same day, Assange attended his seminar at the Swedish trade union headquarters. In the front row of the audience, dressed in an eye-catching pink jumper, you can see her on a YouTube internet clip recorded at the time, was a pretty 20-something whom we shall call Jessica. She was the woman who two sources this week told me is a council employee from Enköping. Jessica would later tell police that she had first seen Assange on television a few weeks before. She had found him interesting, brave, and admirable. As a result, she began to follow the WikiLeaks saga, and when she discovered that he was due to visit Stockholm, she contacted the Brotherhood movement to volunteer to help out at the seminar. Although her offer was not taken up, she decided to attend the seminar anyway and took a large number of photos of Assange during his 90-minute talk. It is believed that by happenstance, Jessica also met Sarah, the woman with whom Assange had spent the night during the meeting. Afterwards, she hung around and was still there when Assange, who has a child from a failed relationship around 20 years ago, left with a group of male friends for lunch. Sources conflict here. One says that she asked to tag along. Another said Assange invited her to join them. And subsequently, one of Assange's friends recalled that Jessica had been very keen to get Assange's attention. She was later to tell police that at the restaurant, Assange put his arm around her shoulder. "I was flattered. It was obvious he was flirting," she reportedly said. The attraction was mutual. After lunch, the pair went to the cinema to see a film called Deep Sea. And Jessica accounts suggest that were intimate, and then went to park where Assange told her she was attractive. But he had to leave to go to a crayfish party, a traditional and usually boozy Swedish summer event. Jessica asked if they would meet again. "Of course," said the WikiLeaks Supremo. He parted, and she took a train back to Enkoping, while he took a cab back to his temporary base at Sarah's flat, where the crayfish party was to be held. You might think it strange that Sarah would want to throw a party in honor of a man about whom she would later make a complaint to police concerning their liaison the night before. This is only one of several puzzling flaws in the prosecution case. A few hours after the party, Sarah apparently tweeted, sitting outside nearly freezing, with the words, "coolest people, with the world's coolest people." It's pretty amazing. She was later to try to erase this message. During the party, Assange apparently phoned Jessica, and a few hours later she was boasting to friends about her flirtation with him. At that point, according to police reports, her friend advised her, "The ball is in your court." So it was that on the Monday, Jessica called Assange, and they arranged to get together in Stockholm. When they did meet, they agreed to go to her home in Enkoping, but he had no money for a train ticket and said he didn't want to use a credit card because he would be tracked, presumably, as he saw it, by the CIA or other agencies. So Jessica bought both their tickets. She had snagged perhaps the world's most famous activist, and after they had arrived at their apartment, they had sex. And according to her testimony to police, Assange wore a condom. The following morning, they made love again. This time, he used no protection. And Jessica reportedly said later that she was upset that he had refused when she asked him to wear a condom. Again, there is scant evidence in the public domain, at least, of rape, sexual molestation, or unlawful coercion. What happened next is difficult to explain. The most likely interpretation of events is that as a result of a one-night stand, one participant came to regret what had happened. Jessica was worried she could have caught a sexual disease or even be pregnant, and this is where the story takes an intriguing turn. She then decided to phone Sarah, whom she had met at the seminar, and with whom Assange had been staying, and apparently confided to her that she'd had unprotected sex with him. At that point, Sarah said that she too had slept with him. As a result of this conversation, Sarah reportedly phoned an acquaintance of Assange and said that she wanted him to leave her apartment. He refused to do so and maintains that she only asked him to leave 3 days later on the Friday of that week. How must Sarah have felt to discover that the man she'd taken to her bed 3 days before had already taken up with another woman? Furious, jealous, out of revenge, perhaps she merely felt aggrieved for a fellow woman in distress. Having taken stock of their opinion for a day or so, on Friday, August 20th, Sarah and Jessica took drastic action. They went together to Stockholm police... My God. They went together to Stockholm police station where they said they were seeking advice on how to proceed with a complaint by Jessica against Assange. According to one source, Jessica wanted to know if it was possible to force Assange to undergo an HIV test. Sarah, the seasoned feminist warrior, said she was there merely to support Jessica. but she also gave police an account of what had happened between herself and Assange a week before. While the female interviewing officer, presumably because of allegations of a sabotaged condom in one case and a refusal to wear one in the second, concluded that both women were victims, that Jessica had been raped and Sarah was subject to sexual molestation. And what the hell? It was Friday evening. A duty prosecuting attorney, Maria Kellerstrand, was called. She agreed that Assange should be sought for on suspicion of rape. And the following day, Sarah was questioned again, cementing the allegation of sexual misconduct against Assange. That evening, detectives tried to find him and searched Stockholm's entertainment district, but to no avail. By Sunday morning, the news had leaked to the press. Indeed, it had been suggested that the two women had discussed approaching a tabloid newspaper to maximize Assange's discomfort. By now, the authorities realized that they had a high-profile case on their hands, and legal papers were rushed to the weekend home of chief prosecutor and dismissed the rape charge. She felt that what had occurred were no more than minor offenses, but the case was now starting to spin out of control. Sarah next spoke to a newspaper, saying, in both cases, the sex had been consensual from the start, but had eventually turned into abuse. Rejecting accusations of an international plot to trap Assange, she added, the accusations were not set up by the Pentagon or anybody else. The responsibility for what happened to me and the other girl lies with a man with a twisted view of women who has a problem accepting the word no. They're two jealous women. When he slept with both of them within a week's time, and they got pissed off. The two women then instructed Claes Borstrom, a so-called gender lawyer, who is a leading supporter of a campaign to extend the legal definition of rape to help bring more rapists to justice. As a result, in September, the case was reopened by the authorities, and last month Interpol said Assange was wanted for sex crimes. Oh, for Christ's sakes. Okay. Yesterday, the lawyer, Mark Stevens, said the Swedish warrant was a political stunt and that he would fight it on the grounds that it could lead to WikiLeaks founder being handed over to American authorities. Sweden has an extradition treaty with the U.S. Well, Assange continues to insist that he has done nothing wrong and that his sexual encounters with both women were consensual. But last week, the Swedish High Court refused to hear his final appeal against arrest, and extradition papers were presented to police in England, where Assange is currently in hiding. He is able to stay in this country thanks to a six-month visa which expires in the spring. So what to make of a story in which it's hard to argue that any of the parties emerges with much credit? How reliable are the two female witnesses? Earlier this year, Sarah reported to have posted a telling entry on her website, which she has since removed, but a copy has been retrieved and widely circulated on the internet, entitled Seven Steps to Legal Revenge. It explains how women can use courts to get their own back on unfaithful lovers. Step seven says, go to it and keep your goal in sight. Make sure your victim suffers as much as you did. And the highlighting of text is Sarah's own. As for Assange, he remains in hiding in Britain, and his website continues to release classified American documents that are daily embarrassing. Clearly, he is responsible for an avalanche of political leaks. Whether he is also guilty of sexual offenses remains to be seen. But the more one learns about the case, the more one feels that unlike the bell in End Coping, the allegations simply don't ring true. And this was written, again, by UK, and this was put out December 7th, which was yesterday. All right? Yesterday. So, but he's, of course, everyone knows now that he's in custody and trouble. And anyway, we're going to... that's that article, and I'm just going to go to another one that I kick out. Now, it says here, and this was written today, it says that Assange could face espionage trials in the U.S., as WikiLeaks founder. Informal discussions have taken place between U.S. and Swedish officials over the possibility of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange being delivered into American custody, according to the diplomatic sources. Mr. Assange is in a British jail awaiting extradition proceedings to Sweden after being refused bail by Westminster magistrate courts, despite a number of prominent public figures offering to stand as surety. His arrest in North London yesterday was described as the U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates as good news and may pave the way for extradition to America and a possible lengthy jail sentence. This is wrong. This is terribly wrong. This is by the Independent UK. I'm going to continue with this article. The U.S. Justice Department is considering charging Mr. Assange with espionage offenses over his website. The Justice Department is considering charging Mr. Assange with espionage offenses over his website and unprecedented release of classified U.S. diplomatic files. Several right-wing American politicians are pressing for his prosecution and even execution, with Sarah Palin, the former vice presidential candidate, saying he should be pursued the same as Al-Qaeda and the Taliban leaders. What a bunch of freaking morons. And, hang on one second. I forgot where I was here. Mr. Assange's appearance in the London court, the focus of massive international media attention, puts Britain in the center of the controversy and recrimination over the publishing of thousands of diplomatic cables, which have caused acute embarrassment to the administration in Washington. If the man responsible for putting them in the public domain is to be silenced, his supporters say the process started here. And the Swedish government seeks Mr. Assange's extradition for alleged sexual offenses against the two women. Sources stress that no extradition request would be submitted unless the United States government laid charges against Mr. Assange, and that attempts to take him to America would only take place after legal proceedings are concluded in Sweden. Mr. Assange, 39, had voluntarily gone to the police station accompanied by solicitors after the issuing of an international warrant. The court heard that Gemma Khan, the sister of conservative MP Zach Goldsmith, the film director Ken Loach, and journalist John Pilger, were among those who had offered to stand bail for the sum of £180,000. But District Judge Howard Rule remanded him in custody on the grounds that there was a risk the WikiLeaks founder could fail to surrender. Mr. Loach, who offered £20,000, explained that he did not know Mr. Assange other than by reputation, but he said, "I think the work he has done has been a public service. I think we are entitled to know the dealings of those that govern us." Mr. Pilger, who also offered £20,000, said he knew Mr. Assange as a journalist and personal friend and had a very high regard for him. "I am aware of the offenses, and I am also aware of quite a lot of detail around the offenses," said Mr. Pilger. "I am here today because the charges against him in Sweden are absurd and were judged as absurd by the chief prosecutor there when she threw the whole thing out until a senior political figure intervened." Mrs. Khan offered a further £20,000 or more if need be, although she said she did not know Mr. Assange. Gemma Linfield appeared for the Swedish authorities, suggested a successfully opposing bail being granted because there was a risk he would fail to surrender, and also for his own protection, she said. She outlined five reasons why there was a risk. His nomadic lifestyle reports that he intended to seek asylum in Switzerland, access to money from donors, his network of international contacts, and his Australian nationality. Mrs. Linfield added, "Any number of people could take it upon themselves to cause him harm. This is someone for whom Simply put, there is no condition, even the most stringent, that would ensure he would surrender to the jurisdiction of this court. Mrs. Linsfield told the court that Mr. Assange was wanted in connection with four allegations of sexual offenses. She said that the first complainant, Miss A, said she was victim of unlawful coercion on the night of the 14th in Stockholm. The court heard Mr. Assange is accused of using his body weight to hold her down in a sexual manner. This second charge alleged Mr. Assange sexually molested Miss A by having sex with her without a condom. Then, when it was her express wish, one should be used. The third charge claimed Mr. Assange deliberately molested Miss A on August 18th in a way designed to violate her sexual integrity. Man, I mean, they can drum up any kind of bullshit charges, can't they? And the fourth charge accused Mr. Assange of having sex with a second woman, Miss W, on 17th of August without a condom while she was asleep in her Stockholm home. Oh, for crying out loud. The phantom guy who, you know, who doesn't use a condom. You know, you got to tell me this woman was sleeping while he was doing it to her? This is totally stupid. Okay, and District Judge Riddle said, the case is not on the face of it about WikiLeaks. It is an allegation in another European country of serious sexual offenses alleged to have occurred on three separate occasions and involving two separate victims. These are extremely serious allegations. From that, it seems to me that if these allegations are true, then no one could argue the defendant could be granted bail. However, he added, if they are false, he suffers a great injustice if he is reprimanded in custody. At this stage, in these proceedings, the nature and strength of the allegations is not known. Mr. Assange's solicitor, John Jones, said he agreed the case was not about WikiLeaks, but was a simple accusation case with a right to bail. He said, in relation to the state of play in Sweden, it is important for the courts to be aware on the background to this. If Mr. Assange has been repeated request that the allegations against him be communicated to him in a language he understands, that has been ignored by the Swedish prosecutor. Another Swedish prosecutor dropped this case early on for lack of evidence, and it was resurrected in Gothenburg rather than Stockholm. Another of Mr. Assange's lawyers, Mark Steffens, said he believed British authorities would go to extreme lengths to ensure his client was perfectly comfortable during the time in jail. While he is confident Mr. Assange's time behind bars will be brief, he said he did not want to appear to be too cocky. I think a lot of people, including the police, thought that he would get bail today. They were very surprised that he didn't, he said. Praising District Judge Howard Riddle's assessment of the case, Mr. Stevens says, we are incredibly grateful to the judge for making it clear to the prosecutor that he thinks he wants to have a look at the evidence to make assessments as to whether there is a real risk of conviction or not, because that will make a difference as to whether or not he wants to put him out on bail or not on the next occasion. Criticizing Swedish authorities involving the case, Mr. Stevens says, it's a persecution, not a prosecution. He maintained that while Mr. Assange was not prepared to go to Sweden to face alleged sexual assault claims, his client was prepared to meet the Swedish prosecutor in England. That, I think, is a reasonable approach, he said. The pressures on WikiLeaks, which relies on online donations from a worldwide network of supporters to fund its work, continued after Visa and MasterCard suspended all payments to the website. A spokesman for Visa E said, Visa Europe has taken action to suspend Visa payment acceptance on WikiLeaks website, pending further investigation into the nature of its business and whether it contravenes Visa operating rules. A MasterCard spokesman said, MasterCard is currently in the process of working to suspend the acceptance of MasterCard cards on WikiLeaks until the situation is resolved. Kristen Hrafson, a WikiLeaks spokesperson, said, WikiLeaks is operational. We are continuing on the same track as laid out before, Any development with regards to Julian Assange will not change the plans we have with regards to the releases today and in the coming days. The legal proceedings. Why is Mr. Assange, an Australian citizen, facing legal process proceedings in the UK when the allegations made against him relate to events in Sweden? Answer. Under the European arrest warrant procedures, any EU state can request the legal assistance of another EU state in the detention of a suspect wanted for an offense committed abroad. Question. Mr. Assange's lawyers say that he is not on the run and has voluntarily surrendered to police, so why is he being held in prison? District Judge Howard Riddle, sitting in the City of Westminster Magistrate Court, refused Mr. Assange's application for bail because he decided there was a danger he might abscond. Question. What happens next? Answer. First, his lawyers will return to court next week to try to secure his release on conditional bail. Eventually, there will be an extradition hearing at which the Swedish prosecution authority will present prima facie evidence to show there is case for Mr. Assange to answer. And how long will the proceedings last? Well, Mr. Assange's legal team are already preparing to challenge the extradition in the High Court in London. If they lose the case there, they will take it all the way to the Supreme Court, a process which could last many months. So that's the current thing that's going on right now on the WikiLeaks issue, according to the British papers. And quite fascinating as far as I'm concerned. This guy, if anybody was set up, this guy was set up. Whoa. And probably by his own doing, messing around with two women in the same week who happened to wind up knowing each other. This thing is quite a little different. Now, this is something that I haven't seen this reported anywhere except on a few websites. But this is a very serious thing going on in Israel right now, and I was very surprised to read this again. This came up today, and it says the Carmel wildfire is burning all illusions in Israel. 4 days after Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced plans to place thousands of migrant workers in prison camp deep in the Negev desert because, as he claimed, they posed a threat to the character of the country, a burning tree trunk fell onto a bus full of Israeli prison service cadets, killing 40 passengers. The tree was among hundreds of thousands turned into ash by the forest fire pouring across northern Israel, and which now threatens to engulf outskirts of Haifa, Israel's third largest city. Over the last 4 days, more than 12,300 acres have burned in the Mount Carmel area, a devastating swath of destruction in a country the size of New Jersey. While the cause of the fire has not been established, it was laid bare the myths of Israel's foundation. On to read more of that. And this is from ukrnet.info. Israelis are treating the fire as one of the greatest tragedies in recent years. A friend who grew up in the Haifa area told me over the weekend that he was devastated by the image of destruction he saw on TV. His friend's brother was among those who perished in the bus's accident. Though he is a dedicated Zionist who supported Netanyahu's election bid in 2008, like so many Israelis, he was furious at the response, or lack of one, by the government. Our leaders are complete idiots, but you already know that, he told me. They invested so much to prepare for all kinds of crazy war scenarios, but didn't do anything to protect civilians from the basic things you are supposed to take for granted. On December 3rd, Netanyahu informed the country, "We do not have what it takes to put out the fire, but help is on its way. To beat back the blaze, Bibi has had to beg for assistance from his counterpart in Turkey, Recep, I can't even pronounce this guy's name, Erdogan. The Western-backed Palestinian Authority and Israelis, American, and British patrons. Israel is a wealthy country that boasts to the world about its innovative spirit. Its U.S.-based lobbyists market it as a startup nation. But its performance during the forest fire revealed the sad truth. Its government has prioritized offensive military capacity and occupation maintenance so extensively that it has completely neglected the country's infrastructure, emergency preparedness, and most of all, the general welfare of its citizens. Beyond the embarrassing spectacle of Turkish supply planes landing in Tel Aviv just 6 months after Israeli commandos massacred Turkish aid volunteers on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, or the confessions of impotence by the hard men Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman, the fire exposed a terrible history that has been concealed by layers of official mythology and piles of fallen pine needles. There are no facts. Among the towns that have been evacuated in Einhod, a Bohemian artist colony nestled in the hills to the north and east of Haifa, there is not the first time Einhod was evacuated, however. The first time was in 1948 when the town's original Palestinian inhabitants were driven from their homes by a man-made disaster known as the Nakba. And most of the original inhabitants of Einhod, which was called Einhod prior to the expulsions of 1948 and was continuously populated since the 12th century, were expelled to refugee camps in Jordan and Jenin in the West Bank. But a small and exceptionally resilient band of residents fled to the hills, set up a makeshift camp, and watched as Jewish foreigners moved into their homes. In 1953, a Romanian Dadaist sculptor named Marcel Janco convinced the army not to bulldoze Einhod, as it did the scores of nearby Palestinian towns it had ethnically cleansed 5 years prior. He proposed establishing an art commune to generate tourism and contribute to the culture of Zionism. Today, the rustic stone homes that once belonged to Palestinians are quaint artist studios, while the village mosque has been converted into an airy bar called Bonanza. Visitors to the town are greeted at the entrance by Benjamin Levy's, the modest couple in a sardine can. The modest couple in a sardine can, a sculpture depicting a nude woman and a suited gentleman in a sardine can, which are unveiled by Israeli President Shimon Peres in 2001. After the catastrophe of 1948, the original Palestinians of Einhod set up their own village 3 kilometers away from what is today known as Einhod. For decades, the villagers resisted attempts to dispossess them and were surrounded by a fence during the 1970s to prevent them from expanding according to natural growth. But they finally won official recognition in 2005. This meant that for the first time since the establishment of Israel, they could receive electricity and trash service. Meanwhile, more than 40 other Palestinian villages inside Israel remain unrecognized. The 80,000 or so residents of the villages, which lay mostly in the Negev desert, are taxpaying citizens of Israel. However, they have very few rights. Their homes are routinely demolished to make way for Jewish settlements, and they are deprived of basic services. I visited both Einhod and Einhod in June. When the residents of the Jewish village Einhod saw me filming, they reacted with a mixture of suspicion and hostility. "I know what you're doing," an elderly woman sneered at me, insisting that I not film her. Inside the bar, I asked patrons if the place was in fact a converted mosque. "Yeah, but that's how all of Israel is," a woman from a nearby kibbutz told me as she sipped on a beer. "This whole country is built on the top of Arab villages. So maybe it's best to get bygones be bygones." This thing gets a little longer than I wanted to read, but I guess you can get the hint of it. If you go to Ukrnet, urukenet.info. Okay, you can read the entire article. It's a very interesting article, and something that you're not going to hear, and it's written by Max Blumenthal. And it's in, like I said, urukenet, urukenet.info. And you can read this article, The Carmel Wildfires Burning an Illusion, All Illusions in Israel. And very, very good article. I highly recommend it. And I'm just going to go on to the next week. We've only got about 20 minutes left. And it was an interesting article that I thought I might read here. A man was sentenced to nearly 3 years in prison for threatening Obama in a poem. A Kentucky man who acknowledged threatening Barack Obama in a poem has been sentenced to nearly 3 years in prison. Johnny Logan Spencer apologized for writing the poem, which described the fatal sniper shooting of the president. Let's go on here. I'm going to read this. This is from Activist Post, by the way. Johnny Logan Spencer apologized for writing the poem, described the fatal sniper shooting of the president. The 28-year-old said in federal court in Louisville on Monday that he was upset over his mother's death and had fallen in with a white supremacist group that had helped him kick a drug habit. U.S. District Judge Joseph McKinley Jr. called Spencer's writing of the poem an extremely dangerous thing. And Spencer will be on supervised release for 3 years after he completes the 33-month sentence. Holy Christ. A poem titled The Sniper was posted on a website in 2007 and again in 2009 after Obama took office. Really amazing to me. Amazing, amazing, amazing. Yeah, you can get trouble for writing a poem. Let's see. It's kind of an interesting thing. As you know, you may know, Ireland has been really crunched lately, and you know, economically, and a lot of riots going on there. There's a short 1.5 minute video I wanted to play. Of course, the audio version, and it just says Ireland faces the most severe welfare cuts and tax hikes in history. The high price it has to pay for receiving an international bailout. The budget is about to face a parliamentary vote, with protesters gathered outside the parliament building, but Socialist Party MEP Joe Higgins believes the Irish financial system is already broken beyond repair. We're going to go to this. This is from Russian TV.
Tax hikes in its history, the high price it has to pay for receiving an international bailout. The budget is about to face a parliamentary vote, with protesters gathered outside the parliament building. But Socialist Party MEP Joe Higgins believes the Irish financial system is already broken beyond repair.
The reality for the Irish economy and for Irish capitalism is that inside or outside of the euro, it faces a disaster because it is so weak and unable to develop society. But I do predict that the level of debt now is simply unpayable. It is unquestionably the case that there will be a default in the next years. So we say, why wait for then and subject our people to enormous pain and suffering for nothing? We should refuse to pay the bondholders now immediately. That's the key point. And then develop a plan to redevelop our economy. What we are making a sacrifice for, in fact, is international banks and billionaire speculators who roam the financial markets looking to make a quick buck. we owe them nothing in terms of the Irish people. Those speculative debts were incurred by private bankers in private deals. We say you cannot fix this system. It is broken beyond repair. It is causing enormous suffering to tens of millions throughout Europe. The speculators are simply watching their next target, which will be Portugal or Spain, now that they've got what they want in Ireland.
I totally agree with this guy. Let the banks fail. Fuck them. Let the banks fail. You know, if people didn't get this far, it was the friggin' banks that did it. And why should they steal, you know, Irish type of Irish money, English money, European money, and American money, especially American money, because we're bailing out all these damn banks. All right? Let those damn banks fail. Yeah, hold on, please. And we continue here. Sorry for that interruption. That was a call that came in, a very important call. I just wanted to go on here. But that was extremely important to note that I believe truly Iceland and the United States, all of them should let the banks just fail. Just let them fail and get them, you know, start over again. This is something that's very, very interesting, and I'm not sure how long this article is, but an extremely interesting article about HAARP. And let's see if it goes too far here. I can. That's not too bad. Iceland under attack. HAARP activity corresponds to Iceland earthquake swarms. Now, HAARP is the H-A-A-R-P, which is the weather modification set up in Greenland, actually, and operated by the United States. But it's really quite a frightening thing. By Zen Gardner, and the website is Before It's News. Can't say for sure, but many jump to the conclusion that every earthquake is the result of HAARP on other atmospheric heater activity. Haiti, for example, did have corresponding HAARP activity and other anomalies. Chile apparently did not. But checking a HAARP monitoring website after seeing the news about the heavy earthquake activity in Iceland, there's clear correlation. Put it this way, we know it's possible for this technology to do such a thing. Here's just one of many reports on HAARP's capabilities. Who would benefit and why Iceland? Iceland didn't take the bailout and hasn't wanted to knuckle under the EU. They still have a strong free market economy and are poised for recovery. That's not the falling in line with the program. Number two, In addition, Iceland recently established themselves as a free speech haven to protect journalists and their sources, even offering censorship-free servers and other services to journalists and internet businesses. That sounds like an idea who's wanting an internet crackdown would like to see happen. Okay, and more volcanoes would also further exacerbate the horrific weather Europe is experiencing. That should keep their minds off of politics. Their engineered economic maelstrom and quells any thought about demonstrating now, wouldn't it? And number four, mighty nice distraction for the wiki storm and all of its fallout, wouldn't you say? And guys, I was just wondering. And there's charts and so on. And interesting, I said, I'm no psychiatrist, but something appears to be going on. Perhaps someone will clarify. And you look, he's showing all the different signs of the HAARP program, pointing to Iceland. Yet another earthquake swarm has rumbled in the region near the Askja volcano, located in east central Iceland, directly over a tectonic plate boundary. And something to keep an eye on. Surely it might be a nice distraction for the WikiLeaks storm and upheavals in Europe. But this is a very interesting insight, and I think and weather as a weapon is definitely for real. See, I've got about 10 more minutes. There's two more that I want to talk about. H1N1 vaccines linked to 700% increase in miscarriages. That's right, folks. Recent data presented in the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Advisory's Committee on Children's Vaccines has revealed some shocking information about the effects of the H1N1 swine flu vaccine on pregnant women. According to the report, the rate of miscarriage among pregnant women during the 2009 H1N1 swine flu pandemic soared by over 700% compared to the previous years, pointing directly to the vaccine as the culprit. But the CDC denies the truth and continues to insist nobody has been harmed. It sounds like our CDC. And this is from Natural News, .com. Very, very good site. Highly recommended. According to the CDC, nearly 50% of all pregnant women were vaccinated with the H1N1 vaccine during the 2009-2010 influenza season. Those whose physicians instructed them to get a seasonal flu vaccine were three times more likely to get it, while those instructed specifically to get the H1N1 shot were 10 times more likely to get it. And the numbers clearly showed that along with the rise in vaccinations due to the H1N1 scare came the sharp increase in miscarriages, including a slew of actual reported adverse events. But the CDC does not seem to care about the facts, as numerous reports indicate the agency has failed to report any of its vital information to vaccine suppliers. In fact, when presented with the data of the third time, Dr. Marie McCormick, chair of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Vaccine Risk and Assessment Working Group, actually had the audacity to claim that there had been no vaccine-related adverse effects in pregnant women caused by the vaccine. This baseless and fallacious assessment of the CDC assessment group has given the green light to the CDC's Advisory Commission on Immunization Practices to continue their recommendation to give 2010 and 11 flu shots to all people, including pregnant women, explained Eileen Daneman, director of National Coalition of Organized Women, presenter of the information. This upcoming 2010-2011 flu vaccine contains the same elements that are implicated in the killing of these fetuses, the H1N1 viral component and neurotoxin mercury. Additionally, it contains two other vital strains, a 3-in-1 shot for all people. Overall, the number of vaccine-related fetal demise reports increased by 2,440% in 2009 compared to the previous years, which is even more shocking than the miscarriage statistic. However, the CDC continues to lie to the public about the vaccines, urging everyone, including pregnant women, to get it. To read this report for yourself, visit www.progressiveconvergence.com. All right? So, progressiveconvergence.com. But I highly suggest that you go to naturalnews.com. Very, very excellent, excellent site. So much news, guys, and so little time. But there's one other that I wanted to try to get ready tonight. this is frightening too, because this is what's happening in the United States and around the world, but the United States is absolutely frightening. It's already happening. The FCC commissioner wants to regulate the news. Representative Joe Barton, a Republican from Texas, pushed back on Monday against a contention by a Democratic FCC commissioner that the government should create new regulations to promote diversity in news programming. Barton was reacting to a proposal made last week by FCC Commissioner Michael Copps, who in a speech suggested that broadcasters be subject to new public values tests every 4 years. I hope that you do not mean to suggest that it is the job of the federal government through the FCC to determine the content that is available for Americans to consume, Barton wrote Monday in a letter to Copps. When a speech suggested that broadcasters be subject to new public values tests every 4 years. Copps has suggested that the test would make a broadcaster's license renewal contingent upon proof that they meet a prospective set of federal criteria. He said outlets should be mandated to do the following: prove they have made a meaningful commitment to public affairs and news programming, prove they are committed to diversity programming, for instance, by showing that they depict women and minorities, report more to the government about which shows they plan to air, require greater disclosure about who funds political ads, and devote 25% of their primetime coverage to local news. The regulations would apply to all news outlets operating on the public airwaves. In his letter, Barton questioned whether Copps believes the government should reinstate the defunct fairness doctrine, a controversial standard that required broadcast licensees to offer balanced coverage. Critics saw it as an affront to free speech. Now, it's questionable whether it is or not. Barton also asked whether 5 commissioners can do a better job of ensuring the Americans have access to wide diversity of content and viewpoints that Americans can themselves by expressing their preferences in their vigorously competitive marketplace. The Federal Communications Commission has an ongoing project about media diversity that promises to issue a report on whether Americans have access to adequate sources of news, but the effort has come under strong criticism, and the FCC has not stated when the report will be released. And the problem with this, as I see, is that, you know, this is from The Hill, by the way, website. The problem that I see with this, being a broadcaster myself and being subject to FCC rules, not so much on the internet here, but on my commercials radio show, is that being a liberal program and being a very and somewhat radical in my statements, it could be, you know, they could wind up causing great problems to the station. But I can't really say that. It's just that I don't know what the new regs are going to be. But if they do bring in the fairness doctrine, it would be rather interesting to see what happens. I try to promote both sides of the issues, conservative and liberal interviews and so on, but at the same time, it'll be very, very interesting to see what comes of that. And I'm finished streaming here, and I'm sorry. Tonight went pretty fast. There's a lot of information. But I want to thank everybody for joining me, and I hope that you'll join me tomorrow night when we talk about when we go into the fourth dimension. I have a great interview with Maria Fix Algeri that I'll be playing tomorrow night, and we'll discuss The Night of the Universe by Madame Blavatsky. And I want to thank everybody for joining me. I hope you had a good time. We will be talking to you soon.